The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I'm going to talk about some of the main themes that I write about in Black Lives Matter, and really try to... I finished writing the book last summer, so I'm going to sort of end by trying to talk about how some of these issues relate to the contemporary, the current moment that we're in, especially in regards to where we're at in the ongoing struggle to stop police violence and its connection to other forms of racial violence in Black America. But to begin with, as we enter into the twilight of the administration of Barack Obama, it's hard to believe that only 8 years ago, when Obama first became president of the United States, pundits and politicians alike dared to suggest that the United States was entering into a post-racial period. It really is hard to believe that with Donald Trump running for president. Indeed, in December of 2008, Forbes magazine ran an enthusiastic editorial that claimed, quote, "Racism in America is over." While most African Americans obviously didn't buy that the country was moving beyond race, almost all Americans were, in almost all of the country, there was widespread optimism that Obama's victory indicated that the country was shedding its long history of racial injustice. How ironic, then, that over the last 19 months of Obama's presidency, we have witnessed the birth of a Black social movement and the revival of radical Black politics. The movement is known by its most popular slogan, Black Lives Matter. It's diffuse, angry, and has emerged in response to the continued plague of police murder, corruption, and violence throughout Black America. Black Lives Matter is not incidental to the Obama presidency, but in many ways is a product of it. What do we make of the emergence of this movement during the ascendance of the nation's first Black president, especially when people assumed that his presidency would bring the end of racism to the United States? You know, some people, a very small group of people. But a small group of people with a loud microphone. 8 years after the election of Obama, very little has changed in the daily reality of most Black people in this country. Black unemployment is still almost twice the national average, despite constant talk of economic recovery. 40% of Black children continue to live in poverty. 55% of all Black workers in this country make under $15 an hour. But even more than the everyday struggles to negotiate and manage poverty and economic inequality, every day are the dramatic examples of how Black men, women, and children continue to suffer the humiliating indignities of racism and injustice. Whether it is a white police officer shooting 16 bullets into the prone and fetal body of a Black teenager as he lay huddled on the street, as is what happened in this city, in Chicago, or whether it is the poisoning of the water in Flint, Michigan, because the governor of the state thinks he can get away with it because the majority of the citizens who lived there were poor and Black. The persistence of these conditions, 8 years into the Obama administration, 51 years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, 151 years after the end of the Civil War, and 150 years since the passage of the nation's very first Civil Rights Act in 1866, which declared, quote, "Citizens of every race and color, without regard to any previous condition of slavery or involuntary servitude, shall have the same right in every state and territory in the United States to full and equal benefit of all laws and proceedings for the security of person and property as is enjoyed by white citizens." The persistence of the gap between the reality for people And the stated formality of freedom in that Civil Rights Act raises the question, what is wrong with the United States? And why are the vast majority of black people treated as if they have no rights this country is bound to recognize or respect? The Black Lives Matter movement is a powerful intervention that not only confronts the scourge of police terrorism, but raises the question of how these conditions of inequality can continue to exist more than 150 years after our formal freedom. But on the eve of Obama's first inauguration, optimism was the prevailing mood. 69% of black people said that King's dream had been fulfilled. There were high expectations that there would be a break with the politics of the past and that actual change was on the way. Obama's candidacy for president in 2007 did not begin with such high expectations. Black voters were skeptical about his ability, his viability as a candidate, and the absence of his civil rights credentials. Black voters put their chips on Hillary Clinton as a sure bet. Obama then transformed his candidacy from the usual affair into something he and his supporters would describe as a social movement. He tapped into the anger and exhaustion of ordinary Americans who were fed up with what seemed like endless war in Iraq, the shredding of our civil rights with the passage of the Patriot Act, and the return to economic recession. Recall how the soaring rhetoric of candidate Obama broke decisively with the status quo in American politics. Obama declared that we, ordinary people, were the change that we had been waiting for. Recall his impassioned pleas of yes, we can. But for black voters especially, Obama's campaign represented the optimism of new beginnings, the belief that perhaps finally this country could fulfill its creed. Not only because he was African American, and we shouldn't discount that in a racist country, the enthusiasm of black voters, but also because of what the Bush administration had represented. From the theft of the election in Florida in 2000 based on disenfranchising black voters, to the collective shrug of the federal government in response to the Hurricane Katrina disaster, black voters turned out for Obama like never before. Young black voters produced the highest proportional voter turnout in the nation's history. For the first time, a higher percentage of eligible black voters supplanted the white electorate. But almost as quickly as Obama became president, so too did the disillusionment with his limitations. It was not all at once, but there were three significant markers for black people that pointed to continuity with the past, not the change that had been promised. The first factor was Obama's benign response to the economic crisis in black communities. As most will know that by the end of 2008, the American economy was in free fall. African Americans would bear the brunt of the Great Recession and economic crisis that ensued. By the end, more than 240,000 black homeowners would lose their houses. By the fall of 2009, black unemployment had reached a high of 15%. Fueled by cuts to federal and state jobs that had always been a bedrock for black employment. Walmart would become the largest employer of black Americans, supplanting the historical role of the U.S. Postal Service. The net worth of black families fell to $11,000 compared to $141,000 for white families. And an alarming 40% of black families had zero or negative wealth. It appeared that a black president was right on time. Who better to understand how racial discrimination and inequality would create uneven access to the programs intended to accelerate the economic recovery? And thus, particular or even, yes, special provisions would have to be made to pull black people out of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. But Obama preached that there was nothing in particular he could do for the growing numbers of black poor, the black unemployed, or black homeowners. Instead, he argued that a rising tide would lift all boats. A second factor contributing to black disillusionment with the black president was how he characterized black poverty. Obama was reluctant to offer particular assistance to African Americans, but he did not show nearly the same reticence when it came to invoking the highly effective stereotypes of blacks as somehow being responsible for their own condition. It was stunning. The entire Western world was blaming Wall Street and its reckless practices for crashing the global economy. In this country, the Occupy movement was an expression of the opposition to the growing gap between rich and poor. As the movement said, the 1% versus the 99%. And while it was often described as a white movement, polls found that 45% of black people expressed a positive view of Occupy, and an additional 35% said the movement was good for the American political system. And yet, even as the structural inequality of capitalism was exposed and spelled out, Barack Obama scolded black parents for feeding their kids cold fried chicken, for watching television instead of reading books, according to him, and indeed lectured black America that there were, quote, no excuses for any predicament they might find themselves in. Without question, some, if not many, black people actually agreed with the criticism of the black poor and working class. It fit the common sense of the last 40 years that African Americans are to blame for the conditions that exist in black communities. Black people, according to this logic, lack morality, personal responsibility, and in general, the personal character to overcome the hardships that everyone must to become successful in this country, or so we are told. It is an argument that has been reinforced at every level of government, in the mass media, in our popular culture. And yet for others, it was an argument that completely contradicted their experience. Black homeowners had played by the rules and were cashing in on the American dream only to be built by mortgage lenders and dirty banking practices and then left penniless. Black college graduates who had played by the rules were still three times as likely to be unemployed as their white peers. Black men with no criminal record and looking for work were as likely to be called back as white men with a criminal record. Discrimination and other objective factors that had nothing to do with the morality or responsibility of African Americans were the culprits behind black poverty. Finally, the growing excesses and brutality of the American criminal justice system, from violent policing to mass incarceration and beyond, demonstrated how much things had remained the same. The moments that Obama had to affirm black concerns with what people were referring to as a criminal injustice system were systematically ignored. For example, in September 2011, an international campaign was underway to save the life of wrongfully convicted black death row inmate Troy Davis. Everyone from the Pope to the European Union, to the governments of France and Germany, and even the former director of the FBI campaigned to save Davis's life. The night that Davis was to be executed, hundreds of black college students across Washington, D.C. marched and rallied at the Supreme Court and at the White House, hoping to lure Obama out of the White House to intervene in some way in order to save Davis's life. But Obama did nothing. He never even made a statement. Instead, he opted to send his spokesperson out to the press the next day to insist that this was, quote, a states' rights issue. For many, this had been the exact reason that Obama had been elected. But instead, it was more of the same. Very little had changed. Finally, the murder of Trayvon Martin and the subsequent acquittal of George Zimmerman marked a clear rupture for some with the Obama administration. Florida officials had coddled and protected George Zimmerman for weeks from being arrested for the death of Martin for more than a month while a movement grew to have him arrested. With the spirit of militant protest having been aroused the previous fall by Troy Davis demonstrations, and the explosion of the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations, marches, protests, sit-ins, and occupations had been validated once again. Black and white activists who had been involved in Occupy, connected with new people, drawn into the streets by the horror of Trayvon Martin's murder. As the protests swelled, Obama was finally forced to speak publicly, but in doing so, he only spoke personally, saying that if he had a son, he might look like Trayvon. Considered poignant by the media, it failed to articulate or resonate with growing black anger against police misconduct in Florida and the refusal of officials to arrest Martin's killer. Eventually, Zimmerman would be arrested, tried, and ultimately acquitted, as Trayvon Martin was transformed from a 17-year-old boy walking home to his father's house to a marijuana-smoking, oversized thug who was the aggressor. When the verdict was announced, Obama implored the public to respect the jury's decision, claiming, quote, "We are a nation of laws." What did this even mean when the Martin case so clearly demonstrated that we are a nation with two sets of laws, one for black people and one for everyone else? Everyone understood that if the tables had been turned, if Martin had violently set upon and shot and killed Zimmerman, he would have been arrested immediately and ultimately convicted. The raised expectations of African Americans, particularly young African Americans, with the Obama presidency, had been dashed over and over and over again. In the aftermath of the Zimmerman verdict, Alicia Garza, a labor organizer in the Bay Area, created the hashtag Black Lives Matter. Its declarative simplicity articulated the anger of a generation, and the pieces of a movement began to take shape, not just with the formation of the Black Lives Matter Network, but this was, quote, seed time for the development of new organizations like the Dream Defenders in Florida or Black Youth Project here in Chicago, in addition to any number of local grassroots coalitions that came together to challenge police brutality in their own localities. What was clear was that the black president and an unprecedented number of black elected officials could not even perform the most basic task, including keeping black children safe from the racist agents of the state. The young people would have to do it themselves. The focus of this new movement was on police violence, but there was no shortage of issues around which people could organize. Police brutality is not new, however. As early as 1951, a multiracial contingent of activists in the Civil Rights Congress raised the slogan, "We Charge Genocide," to characterize the depth and consequences of police murder and the silent complicity of the state. The preamble of their petition read in part, quote, "There was a time when racist violence had its center in the South. Once most of the violence against Negroes occurred in the countryside, but that was before the Negro immigrations of the 20s and 30s. Now there is not a great American city, from New York to Cleveland or Detroit, from Washington, the nation's capital, to Chicago, from Memphis to Atlanta or Birmingham, from New Orleans to Los Angeles, that is not disgraced by the wanton killing of innocent Negroes. It is no longer a sectional phenomenon. Once the classic method of lynching was the rope, now it is the policeman's bullet. To many in America, the police are the government, certainly its most visible representative. We submit that the evidence suggests that the killing of Negroes has become police policy in the United States, and that police policy is the most practical expression of government policy. Today, again, there is no shortage of issues to organize around, but police brutality remains the catalyst for black protest because it is the clearest example of the compromised citizenship of black people. When the police can approach you, search you, arrest you, and even kill you with impunity. It means that you don't have first-class citizenship. You have second-class citizenship. And this second-class citizenship and its sharp conflict with what the United States says about itself is what drives the radicalization of young black people and others who know it to be true. In other words, we as a nation are always told that this is the greatest country on earth. We believe in American exceptionalism and the promises of unfettered opportunity for anyone willing to work for it. We believe in the American dream. When Obama traveled to Cuba earlier this year, he said in his speech, quote, "I believe that every person should be equal under the law. Every child deserves the dignity that comes with education and health care and food on the table and a roof over their heads. American democracy has given our people the opportunity to pursue their dreams and enjoy a high standard of living." But what on earth do these words mean to the family of Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old boy that was shot and killed by police within 1.6 seconds of their arrival? What does it mean when the cops who killed him face no charges? What does that mean to Ayanna Jones, a 7-year-old girl sleeping on a couch in her house in Detroit, who was killed by police in a botched raid on the wrong house? What does it mean that those officers will not be punished? Far from a democracy where everyone can pursue their dreams, the movement has exposed what the vast majority of black people in America know to be true. That in inner cities across this country, there exists a police state where the police are governed by a completely different set of rules, where they can kill, where they are empowered to do what they want, when they want, all with the intention of maintaining discipline and control over the country's black population. Don't take my word for it. A commission created by Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel in the wake of the killing of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald released a report earlier this year and found many things. It said, just to quote a small part of this, this is a report that was commissioned by Emanuel. It was a panel that was the product of many protests because activists wanted ordinary people on this panel. They didn't want hand-picked representatives from Emanuel to convene this panel, but that's who ended up doing it. And so this is what Rahm Emanuel's hand-picked panel had to say about the Chicago police. Quote, "The outrage around Laquan McDonald's killing exposed deep and long-standing fault lines between black and Latino communities on the one hand and the police on the other, arising from police shootings, to be sure, but also about daily pervasive transgressions that prevent people of all ages, races, and ethnicities and gender across Chicago from having basic freedom of movement in their own neighborhoods. Stopped without justification, verbally and physically abused, and in some instances arrested and then detained without counsel, Chicago Police Department's own data give validity to the widely held belief that police have no regard for the sanctity of life when it comes to people of color." And if you think that's an exaggeration, consider this. Since January of 2015, American police have killed 1,405 people. According to the findings of a study conducted by the Bureau of Justice Statistics on police homicides, in the years 2003 to 2009 and 2011, American police killed 7,427 people. That is an average of 928 people a year. If we include the last 4 years, from 2011 to 2015, or from 2012 to 2016, American police will have been responsible for killing more than 11,000 people. In 2015, when the Guardian newspaper began to keep track of police killings, they found that young black men aged 15 to 34 were 9 times more likely than other Americans to be killed by the police. Now consider that 22 American soldiers were killed in Afghanistan, a war zone, last year, or that 25 people were killed by law enforcement in the country of Canada in 2015. In the last 24 years, police in England have killed 55 people. By January 31st of this year, American police had already killed 89 people. In Germany, police killed no one in 2013 or 2014. In China, with a population 4.5 times the size of the United States, they recorded 12 police killings in 2014. And this is only a fraction of what we know. There are 18,000 police departments in the United States, and only 1,000 of them bother to report to the federal government each year how many people they kill. The New York City Police Department, for example, has not reported on how many civilians it has killed since 2007. The state of Florida doesn't bother to report at all. So we have a very limited view of the extent of police homicide in the United States. And because of the lack of consistent tracking, we have no idea what proportion of these deaths are incurred by African Americans or Latinos, although we know it to be disproportionately higher. The police in the U.S. have always been an oppressive institution, but these practices have become worse and more widespread recently. The increasing brutality of American police has coincided with the attrition of an already weakened American welfare state. The political establishment in its Republican and Democratic clothing is gutting our schools and neighborhoods, public schools, mental health clinics, cutting funding for public hospitals and public libraries. And when you cut welfare, housing assistance, and food stamps in the midst of a job crisis, where there are already 47 million poor people in the country, you are creating the conditions for crime. You are certainly not combating them. But policing has become the public policy of last resort, intended to contain crime to certain neighborhoods, not actually stop it. For example, the section of Baltimore where young Freddie Gray, whose death ignited the Baltimore Rebellion in April of 2015, the section of Baltimore where he lived, there were 21% of people in that neighborhood unemployed. 25% of the buildings were abandoned and in a state of disrepair. Life expectancy is 6 years shorter in that neighborhood than in the rest of the city. 55% of families in Freddie Gray's neighborhood were living on less than $25,000 a year. 30% of people there were living, officially living below the poverty line. 3 weeks before Freddie Gray was captured and then killed, police were instructed to increase their presence and arrests on the corner that Gray was eventually picked up on. The police had been inserted where the rest of the state had failed its citizens. This key role played by the police in governing our cities today means that they are a protected class governed by a separate set of rules and regulations. This is why mayors and councilpersons regularly turn a blind eye to brutal policing. It is simply the cost of doing business. And the cost of doing business is quite high. In the city of Chicago alone, they have spent $500 million over the last 10 years, $500 million over the last 10 years, to settle or pay out lawsuits against the city for police brutality and wrongful death suits. The New York City Police Department has averaged $100 million settlements for police brutality and wrongful death suits a year over the last decade, adding up to $1 billion. The 10 cities with the largest police departments paid out $248 million last year in settlements and court judgments in police misconduct cases. That was up 48% from 2010. In the last 5 years, those same 10 cities have paid over $1 billion in settlements. Any other public institution that incurred this kind of expense or deficit would have its budgets cut, its services shrank, or the institution itself would be shut down. When the Chicago Board of Education claimed it was running a $1 billion deficit, they simply closed 52 schools and never looked back. Policing in the United States has nothing to do with crime. As activists and radicals, we don't deny that crime is an issue in the lives of working class and poor people. But crime is a product of poverty and economic inequality. We live in the richest country in the history of the world. If the United States wanted to end poverty in this country tomorrow, it could. Since the economy crashed in 2008, the federal government has spent close to $4 trillion in a bailout of the nation's financial sector. The federal government spent $438 billion to bail out Citibank alone. $4 trillion, if you can even wrap your imagination around it, could transform every school, provide health care for every person, provide housing for millions of people, end food insecurity, and upend the kind of economic inequality that produces crime in the first place. But while it was determined that the banks were too big to fail, our public schools, hospitals, and other vital institutions were continued to be too insignificant to save. Instead of money and wealth and other resources being dedicated to eradicating poverty, we get policing and more policing and more policing and more policing. And the logic of policing only begets more policing as elected officials create political value out of rising arrest rates and falling crime rates by aggressively tracking policing statistics and turning them into campaign fodder. Police are rewarded not for stopping crime, but for making arrests. And finally, as revenue streams have tightened in American cities, as no American politician will take responsibility for raising taxes, law enforcement has become a de facto way for municipalities to raise funds on the backs of the politically weak and vulnerable. In city after city, reliance on red light cameras, endless ticketing, fines, fees have turned into a municipal lifeline. New York City profited from $10 million a week and parking tickets. The city has also made almost $1 billion a year in court and administrative fines. These, of course, create incentives for the police to target people and entire neighborhoods as sources of income. And encounters with the police of this nature, of course, then envelop people into the criminal justice system, thereby making it even harder to get a job or maintain any level of economic stability. In other words, ending police terrorism also means recognizing it as the logical outcome of a brutal society that willfully turns a blind eye to economic inequality and injustice. It means that police brutality and murder are not the products of, quote, bad apples, but they are built into a system that actually has no solution to poverty, racism, and inequality. Instead, the system and its representatives manage the products of inequality. It is for this reason that there has never been a golden age of policing that any of us can point to as a place to get back to when the police were not violent and abusive. Such a period does not exist. The need to build a larger movement is not something to suggest so that we can all get along or feel good about ourselves. It is really about coming to terms with the enormity of the task when we talk about ending police terrorism in our communities. For as much as the movement has accomplished in exposing the issue of police violence, we are right now witnessing the resilience and determination of the political establishment to protect criminal killer cops. There are any number of examples from any city in this country that you can point to. Some are more egregious than others. Akai Gurley in New York, his killer, Peter Lang, a cop who walked into a stairwell corridor that had no lights and just shot his gun and just happened to shoot someone and kill him, gets 5 years of probation. In Cleveland, as I mentioned earlier, the refusal to indict Tamir Rice's killers. The decision in South Carolina to grant the cop who killed Walter Scott, the black man who was running from the police and shot 8 times in the back. The judge decided to give him bail because he felt sorry for the cop being separated from his family for so long. The embattled mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, who put his personal puppet in as the police chief, who then in his first public utterances had the audacity to say that in his 27 years as an officer in the city of Chicago, he had never seen an instance of police misconduct. There was a decision of a San Francisco judge to reinstate police officers who exchanged texts that declared, among many things, white power, all niggers must hang, niggers should be spayed. I just saw one with 4 kids, forced to rehire. The decision in Chicago again to grant bail to Jason Van Dyke, the cop who shot Laquan McDonald 16 times. 13 months, we can see the resilience in the fact that 13 months have passed since the Obama Commission on how to improve policing in the United States was publicized. The commission report produced 59 recommendations that were to improve policing. Not one of them has been implemented. So on and so forth. The political establishment led by Barack Obama is always willing to throw together a commission, invite activists to a roundtable, unveil countless studies with the objective of creating the illusion that something is happening. And they try to convince us, the rest of us, that something is progress. But what we are confronting is the systemic, rooted, and institutional feature of racism and oppression in the society. And it requires a political strategy that can challenge it, but also look beyond it. These are the things that we can do now, but our goals of black liberation cannot simply be measured in units of reform and that which is possible today. The fight for real freedom requires the fundamental transformation of a society founded on genocide, that flourished because of slavery, and that simply thrives today on economic inequality. Last year was the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War, and with it, the first declaration of civil rights for African Americans. This year, we continue to celebrate the 50th anniversaries of the civil rights movement from the decade of the 1960s. But as long as the question of black freedom is only ever asked within the context of this existing society, as long as it is posed as a question to today's existing political institutions, it will never be answered. Simply put, we cannot vote or even protest our way into ending racism in a society where racial inequality and racial injustice is so tightly wound into the marrow of its bones that there is literally no period in time in its existence where black oppression was not a key feature. This is not a reason for despair, but a sober reminder of what exactly it is we are fighting for. What are the social forces that can lead a struggle for a new society based on freedom and justice? What are the politics necessary to shape the struggle for a new society? These are not new questions, but they are debates that have animated the struggle for black liberation for as long as black people have been struggling for freedom in the United States. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.